Okay, so some things still needed to go through before the end of the course. So where we left off was the feedback and positive feedback, and we were discussing about the oscillations that can happen when we have a certain condition for positive feedback, namely when the for the transfer function for the whole system. In the transfer function, the denominator goes to zero. So when the a times b is minus one, so there is a inversion, and then the magnitude is one. So now we will talk about the stability, which is not only issue for positive feedback systems, but also for negative feedback systems, where the transfer functions of each part or various parts of the system are not only real numbers, but they have these complex contributions as well. So we usually have these capacitive and inductive elements present in real life and real systems, so they introduce these imaginary parts in the transfer functions, and they can pose some problems. So we have used to see this phase shift in various filters and amplifier circuits. So that phase shift, when it reaches this 180 degrees, the gain reaches unity, then we have problems. Or, of course, if we want to make an oscillator, then we don't have problems. But in cases where we want to have a stable non-oscillating system, then this configuration or this point where the phase and gain are at the same time at certain level, then we can have issues. And let's see, and that's a stability issue. So we will go through how that can be taken into account, various forms. So far we've been mostly considering this A and B transfer functions as real gains. But then if we take into account the phase angle, then we can turn actually a negative feedback. So for certain frequencies, a system is functioning as it's supposed to be as a negative feedback system. But at certain frequencies, it can turn into a positive feedback, which is then can be unstable. So all amplifiers in real life, they fall, the gain falls at high frequencies, and we have some sort of phase shift happening. So that's just as like reality, and we've seen that in the examples and the exercises what we have been doing so far. And if you have a multi-stage amplifier or multi-stage filter, as we saw last time with this RC ladder configuration, there is a possibility that this system can produce this 180 degree phase shift at some frequencies. So in order to kind of ensure that the system is stable, then we have this Parkhausen condition that we learned last time, that if we want to make a stable system, we have to avoid that condition. So if we make the system so that we are not meeting that condition, then there won't be oscillation, and then our system is more stable. So in order to avoid that condition, we must ensure that the gain falls below unity, so it goes below one before the phase shift reaches 180 degrees. So if we look at both the gain and the phase shift, and if we have a phase shift that goes 180 degrees at some point in frequency, we must check that the gain drops below one before that. So if it happens that they happen at the same time that we have 180 degrees of phase shift and unity gain at the same frequency, then we have the oscillation problem. And also if we have at 180 degrees, we have still some, the gain is still higher than one, then we don't have like oscillations that goes forever, but we have this unstable behavior that there's some oscillation in transitions that of course is something that you usually want to avoid. So if the gain goes below unity before the phase goes at 180 degrees, then we don't have this kind of oscillation behavior, which would make some problems possibly. So there are some kind of units or measures for this, and those are called gain and phase margins. So we call this margin, that there is a certain margin for error or margin for stability, and in this case that how much more we can like tune before it goes to unstable conditions. So how far we are from the unstable conditions. So these margins tell you that. So phase margin is that when we check the loop gain, so this AB gain, and we check that, okay, when that is one, so what is the phase shift at that point and how far it is from 180 degrees? So that is the phase margin. And gain margin is then the opposite. So we check the phase difference and then we see that, okay, that's 180 degrees. And how far is the gain from unity? So unity gain is 0 decibels. So how far we are from 0 decibel gain before, so that's the margin for gain. So we can tune the gain and if you want, if there is still, if it's too close to, so it should be below unity, so some decibels below, so that's what we want. But if it's too close to unity, we are close to that point of instability, so we start seeing these transients or oscillation behavior, which dies or fades in time, but we still have them. But when we tune the phase the gain margin higher and higher, so we kind of have the gain falling much below unity, then we will have less and less of that oscillation behavior in the beginning of a transient response, for example. So here is kind of illustration of this gain margin and phase margin in Bode diagrams. So Bode diagram is showing you have the gain in logarithmic terms. So we have decibels in y-axis, logarithmic frequency usually given in x-axis. And then for the phase, we have the angle phase angle in the y-axis, and then the same logarithmic frequency data on the x-axis as and if we kind of plot them like side by side or like this, that you can see that like from top to bottom, that if you take unity gain and you kind of draw a a line and check what's the phase angle at that point. And you check that how far is that phase angle from 180 degrees, like here. That's the phase margin. So we are still at unity gain, we are still that far from the instability point, like the oscillation point, from the Parkhausen criterion. And on the other hand, if you check that what is the gain at which the phase shift actually reaches 180 degrees, so we take from phase shift data and we draw a line from 180 degrees point to the gain data, and we see that, okay, the gain at that point in frequency is something, and how far off we are from unity gain, and that's our gain margin. So the higher the gain margin and higher the phase margin, the more stable our system is. So if these go too close to each other, so the gain margin closes to zero and phase margin as well, then we start having these oscillation problems. Another type of diagram, which we haven't discussed yet for this type of AC system, so AC analysis. So we've been used to talk about and checking the Bode diagrams, which basically has a lot of information. So it has the gain as a function of frequency, and it has the phase angle as function of frequency. But then there is another type of diagram which basically combines the phase angle and the gain in one plot, and it's called a Nyquist diagram. And we will show that in a minute. So basically what the Nyquist diagram is, that it plots the real part and imaginary part of the gain or the transfer function, in this case the loop gain AB, for all frequencies. So we're going from zero frequency to infinity, basically, and it draws the imaginary part and real part in one plot, and it looks like something like this. So we have the x-axis is the real part, y-axis is the imaginary part, and if you would have a bandpass amplifier or bandpass filter, this diagram now doesn't show exactly what is the is this one here, or is it something else, but nonetheless we can plot a bandpass amplifier or bandpass filter transfer function in this kind of Nyquist diagram. So we can start from low frequency, so zero frequency, it will give for bandpass filter, it will give you zero. So the vector length is zero here. Then we start increasing the vector length. So we take from zero and we take a vector to a certain point. And when we reach this L point here, that's our low frequency cutoff frequency and point. So there we have this 0.707 vector length here. And then we continue the vector grows and grows and grows, and the this angle here, which is so at the beginning, if we just take the first non-zero frequency, this vector points more or less directly up. So we have a 90 degree phase shift, and then the phase shift starts to get smaller and smaller and smaller, and then here it's zero. The vector points directly to the right, and it's all real, and that's our midband frequency. And then we start going up and up, then our vector length starts decreasing again, and the phase shift starts to be non-zero, and then we reach this high frequency cutoff point. At this point here in U, and then higher and higher frequencies. So when we approach infinity, then our vector is getting smaller and smaller, so it basically goes to zero. But the first or the last finite value, the vector points directly down, and we have -90 degree phase shift. So that's kind of the illustration of how this Nyquist diagram works. The drawback for this is that this doesn't hold explicitly the information about the frequency. So you don't know exactly, just by looking at this diagram, what's the frequency at which this midband frequency happens, or where when this L and Y points are in frequency. So it just shows you the relationship between the imaginary part and real part. For this type of one pole network, or in this case two zeros point, so you have these two cutoff frequencies, and it's this kind of just a simple circle. But when we have several poles, so we have an active or several stages in filters, or active filters, active amplifiers, where we can have several degrees, then we have more complex looking Nyquist diagram. But then also the Borden diagram looks, so we have this in the cutoff band, when the gain starts to fall, and when we have the most rapid change in the phase shift, then even in the Bode diagram, it's hard to tell when you have 20 decibels per decade, and when you have 40 decibels per decade, and when you have 60 decibels per decade. And you can see them, but then from the stability analysis point of view, you don't necessarily read that so easily. So this Nyquist diagram is kind of making that analysis and checking of the stability a little bit easier. And how it's well, let's go first a few examples. So how the Nyquist diagrams look like if we have a DC coupled, a single frequency cutoff amplifier. So we have DC coupled means that the zero frequency is amplified with the amplification of that given amplifier. And we have this, the gain is constant from zero frequency to a certain cutoff frequency at high frequencies. So how it looks like, it looks like this. So we have this half circle starting from here. So the unit, so the zero frequency gain is the vector from zero to this point, and it's all real. So we have zero phase difference, and then when the frequency starts to increase, the vector starts to move here, 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 and at some point we have this 45 degree phase shift, and that's the point when we have this -3 decibel point over here. So the gain has dropped -3 decibels, and then we continue going higher and higher frequency, and eventually the phase shift approaches -90 degrees, and the gain approaches zero. So zero in so the gain zero is basically means that it's minus infinity in decibels, because if you think that zero logarithm base logarithm of zero, it's not defined, so it kind of approaches to minus infinity in decibels, decibel terms. So if you would have two cutoff frequencies for a DC coupled amplifier. So again, zero frequency, we have a certain amplification, and then at high frequencies, the amplification starts to go down. And if we have two of the two frequencies in the system, so that first it at a certain frequency we start to go 20 decibels per decade, and after the next frequency we start going we there's another 20 decibels per decade. Then we have 40 decibels at after the second cutoff frequency. And how it looks like in Nyquist diagram, it looks like this. So it kind of it gets skewed. So we have negative real parts for the highest frequencies. And then if you look at the when it approaches the origin, so zero gain, basically if we just approach, we kind of approach it from the left. So at highest frequencies, so when we approach infinity in frequency, we approach the phase difference approaches 180 degrees. And then if we have three frequency cutoffs, then it gets even more skewed. So now we go take another turn, and then we go and we approach from the top. So we go a little bit over to the left to the negative real parts, and then we go to positive imaginary parts, and then we approach while the frequency approaches infinity, the phase shift approaches minus 270 degrees. So we have started going negative here. So 0, 90, minus 90 degree, minus 180 degree, minus 270 degree. So we could as well consider the other way around. So we would go here and it would be 360, and then go back here and go to 90. So, and here it would be 180 degrees. So it doesn't matter in this kind of situation whether you, it's just a matter of definition how you define it. So 180 degree is exactly the same as minus 180 degree. And then if you have a kind of a, just for illustration purposes, if you have an amplifier which has two low frequency cutoffs, so it's AC coupled. So we have the DC frequencies doesn't go through. So they have zero gain. So we start from here, and then we start going here. So we have two cutoff frequencies at low frequencies. So it looks like this one, but just a mirror image. So we go to positive imaginary parts. Then we have the midband gain over here, so everything is real, and that's our midpoint for gain, zero phase. And then so we start from minus, or we start from 180 degree phase shift, and then we go to 90 degree, then we approach to zero, and then we go to negative, we go to minus 90, minus 180 degree, and then we go to minus 270 degree. So we make a loop like this when we change the frequency. So what's the use for this kind of diagram is that if we now think about the criterion for the instability and the Barkhausen criterion that was given earlier, and when we plot the Nyquist diagram for this product AB, and then we think about the point in this imaginary axis or imaginary coordinates, this minus one, so real minus one, zero imaginary, so point over here. So now if we consider the length from this point, instead of having from the origo and checking the vector from length. So if we now consider the length from this point, so if we like start from here and look at the starting point for this example curve, so it's basically gives us the denominator for which is for the whole transfer function. So if we start from zero, for example, here, so the denominator is now one. Then we start increasing. So we draw a line or vector from different points of this curve, and then we reach this midband gain point over here, all real. Then the vector length is from zero to that point plus one. So we are still, we kind of represent with this kind of idea, we represent the denominator of the transfer function. And the thing is that when we enter with this AB transfer function or AB product, when this curve enters this circle here, so for those frequencies that are inside over here, then the total transfer function is actually no longer negative feedback, but it's a positive feedback, because then 1 plus AB, so AB is now a point somewhere over here, and then we sum 1 to that, then that this, for example, this point here, the length is less than 1. And that means that the denominator of the total transfer function is less than 1, so we are actually in a positive feedback situation. It's still not a unstable situation, it's just that at those frequencies, the gain is higher than what would be the forward path gain. So in those frequencies, the total gain of that system is higher than A, because the total frequency, the total transfer function is A over 1 plus AB. And if the denominator is less than 1, then the total the total of that equation is higher than A. So that this is the kind of the reason why we use this Nyquist diagrams in order to see whether we have some frequencies which enter this sphere. And closer we go to this point, the more and more we have this oscillation at those frequencies, which eventually die if we have, for example, if we never go around to this point. So if we never touch this point, we are okay. But if this curve here would go around this point or go to this point, then we have problems. So whenever this P over here, which is the kind of the locus of the of this curve, so it in this case it's drawn over here, but it can be whatever point in this solid curve. So whenever that point P on this curve enters to this this region, then we have this 1 plus AB is less than 1. So we have a positive feedback for those frequencies. And as said, if that P passes through point minus 1, 0, so real 1 and imaginary 0, then we have this condition that the amplifier gain is infinite and we have unstable and condition and it will start oscillating. So I said last time, in some cases we want, if we want to make an oscillator, that's actually the condition that we want to make the system to go. But if we want to avoid the oscillation, then we need to avoid that condition. So it's it depends on what you want. So there is this special case of oscillators that you want to do it, but most of the rest of the situations you want to avoid that. So if that locus P, so if the curve never enters that unit circle that is centered by, that there should be minus one here and here. I need to check that. So that circle that was given in, then we are okay. So the circuit is stable and it's negative feedback and no problems at all. And if it enters, then we have, for those frequencies, the feedback is positive, and it depends on the requirements of your system whether that is a problem or not. And if the locus encircles the point, minus one, zero, then the amplifier will oscillate. So if it hits it, or if it kind of goes around it, maybe I can... So if we have a case where this curve would kind of go around here and go like this to the zero, then it's again and it's unstable and it will start oscillating. So that's the case when we have this kind of growing oscillation that I there was a demonstration last time, that when the we had this oscillator, this Wien-Bridge oscillator, and then when we tune it, or no, it was the RC ladder oscillator, when we had this A equals 29, then we had like so kind of good oscillation. So we had this certain amplitude that remained the same throughout the time, and it and the frequency was configured or determined by the RC constants, which is for that kind of system, it's desired condition, because we wanted to make an oscillator. But when, if we would increase that forward path gain, so the A went to 30 or even slightly above 90 to 29, then what it means that we no longer go through this point, but we go like slightly off and we encircle and this point, and we go like this. And then what it does, the oscillation grows and grows and grows and grows and grows, and then eventually we will hit the saturation, and depending on the system, whether we will break something or it will just saturate to maximum voltages, and it's no longer, so it just bounces back and forth between two points, and it's not necessarily something that we want. So that's then unstable condition. So let's see, clear. Models. So rule of thumbs is that if an amplifier has less than or one, only one upper and lower cutoff frequencies, it will be always stable. So because we are always on the right hand part of the right half of the of this Nyquist diagram, from kind of everything is it's all always real, the real parts of the transfer function is always positive, let's say it that way. But if we have two upper or two lower cutoff frequencies, then we enter to the negative real values for the transfer function. And then we enter to that sphere or the circle where for some frequencies we have this positive feedback. But because you only have two of the low and or upper cutoff frequencies, for some frequencies it's positive, but still we are talking about a stable system. So what we see is that the gain for a certain frequency range, the gain goes higher than in the pass band, but it's not yet unstable, so that we don't have this kind of a infinite case where it kind of just goes widely off to the infinity, and then we are still stable. But if we have more than two of these upper or lower cutoff frequencies, then we can have an unstable condition. So if it depends on the gain or the gains and the product, this AP product, whether the locus of this P curve either passes through this point, -1, 0, or encircles it. So both are unstable. So the oscillation is unstable condition, but that's the condition that we sometimes, in some special cases for oscillators, we want to achieve. But the other, if we go from the left, we encircle that point, then it's always unstable, and it's all pretty much always a condition that we want to avoid. Okay, so here's a just kind of a reminder and showing how this RC ladder looks like in this Nyquist diagram. So here we have a high pass filter system. So now we have these three. So in this case, in this picture, we have a kind of general case that there could be more than three, but we had this three stage RC ladder. So three RC filters, all R's and R's, all C's are equal. So we had this transfer function for this system. So input signal to the output signal is the ratio is something like this. And if we now plot that in the Nyquist diagram, so we start from zero, and then we go, it's hard to see, but it goes to negative imaginary values first, and then it goes back, and then it goes to positive, and it goes through this minus 1/29 point and zero imaginary point over here, and then it goes and drops. At high frequencies, we have a unity gain because this is high pass filter, so high frequencies, they go through the system unattenuated. So now we have for that, we can see that, okay, that's we are in the sphere, that is kind of somewhere over here. We are inside that sphere, but we are not enclosing or encircling that point, that -1, 0 point, which is somewhere over here actually. So we are quite far off from there. So we have positive. We can make a positive feedback with this system, but it's still not unstable as it is. But if we now just multiply this with 29, so we have an amplifier that has a amplification or gain 29, then it's really simply we just multiply each point by 29. So this point here becomes -1. So it turns from here to here. This point goes from being 0.4 in real and 0.5 something in imaginary part. It just jumps up and jumps like 20, 29 times 0.4 goes somewhere over here, and 0.5 something jumps up. So it just scales. So now, if we would draw the both of them in the same plot, the original plot would be just this tiny, tiny little thing over here, because it would end at one over here, so you wouldn't even see it, how it looks like. Because we have now, this is 29 over here, so at high frequencies, this system will have a gain of this AB is having a gain of 29. But this is not the total transfer function of the system, because we have this is part of the so this is only the feedback path times the forward path. So we are now just looking at this product AB, not the whole system. So those two are different. That's something to remember, because the AB, just that product determines the stability conditions for the whole system. When we have the feedback system. Okay, then we have this, I've been talking about this as well. So we have always some stray capacitances and stray inductances in circuits. So all the wires and components themselves, they have capacitance and inductance that we don't normally take into account. If we just consider, if we take a resistor, for example, we just consider the resistance of that. But if it's a normal, so-called normal resistor, which has maybe long leads, and if you put it so that you don't cut the wires at all, then you have long legs for that resistor, which then, of course, it has more and more inductance and possibly more and more capacitance, because there's more and more area associated with those legs. And at high frequencies, those contributions start to play a role in the response of that particular component. And when you make it a circuit and you make a negative feedback circuit, just a normal feedback system with an operational amplifier, let's say you make a non-inverting amplifier, and then you put the resistors there and wires from the input to the source and from the output to the oscilloscope and whatever, and long wires without any shielding and nothing like that. So there's a lot of inductivity or inductance and capacitive elements which you might not think at the first place, but when you measure it, you might see this kind of a unstable behavior at certain frequencies. So you might see an oscillation which eventually might die, or in the worst case, the system might go into a wild oscillation behavior that it just oscillates and never stops. And that's where when you have these stray capacitances there associating with a feedback, this AB product in the feedback loop that... actually produces this positive feedback and it actually goes to this unstable conditions, which in the first place you don't even realize that they are not supposed to be there, but they are, because the circuit design would need some improvements. So this is especially a problem with high frequency applications. When we go to megahertz, is hundreds of megahertz, gigahertz, then there are always these problems that you need to take into account. It's not always a really severe problem that you end up having a really problematic oscillation, or like wild oscillations. But usually, what happens is at high frequencies, you have some sort of kind of overshoots or or this kind of a ringing behavior that they are whenever you have a high transient signal, there is some oscillations that dies or and fades away in time, but it's still there and it might kind of interfere with your data acquisition or whatever. And then of course you would need to rethink the circuit and improve that for these high frequencies in order to get rid of these stray capacitance and stray inductance contributions. Okay, key points for this chapter. So positive feedback, we can see it and we can kind of use it in analog and also in the digital system. So we can, it can be seen in both. And the primary use is to make oscillators. So all the rest is something to this. Oscillators is primary reason to like to try to have a positive feedback. Other than that, it's usually something that you try to avoid as much as possible. And the requirements for oscillation is that it's this Barkhausen criterion that this loop gain AB must have magnitude of one exactly, and the phase shift should be 180 degrees or a plus some integer multiple of 360. As long as it's one and it's pointing left in the real imaginary coordinates. So if you are using a non-inverting amplifier, then we need this 180 degree, but then if you use an inverting amplifier, an inverting amplifier already itself has 180 degree phase shift, but usually the inverting amplifier, it has the gain is already much at those 180 degree phase shifts. Like in normal operation, if you think about the inverting amplifier, the gain is much higher than one. So that's why we don't have problems with the inverting amplifiers like from the first place. But if we make an inverting amplifier and then we make so that the feedback loop or the loop gain, this AB, is actually one, and we have this 180 degree from the inversion of the amplifier, then we have a problem. And if you want to make oscillators, and oscillators usually are needed for clocks or something that is kind of oscillating controllably, so we have a control and it's rather stable in frequency. So we have a certain oscillation that the frequency of that oscillation is controlled and it's stable throughout the time, so it doesn't wander. So it's not like 100 megahertz plus minus 50 megahertz, so that's usually useless. So and if it's kind of going randomly between those frequencies and it's kind of never like it's hard to use as an oscillator for any purposes. So you would like to have a stable frequency that it doesn't kind of go all over the place. And for that, usually these crystals are good to use because then we have this piezoelectric mechanism then that itself is quite well controlled. So it behaves quite well. They are not like 100% perfect, but they're still the frequency stability is good. So now we are talking about stability, the frequency stability of an oscillator, and then we are talking about the stability of a feedback system. So those two stabilities are two different things. So that is something to also take into account and remember. So this or oscillators are one thing when we want to kind of have controlled instability for the system. So it oscillates in a certain manner that we can control. And all the rest, practically all the rest applications, we want to avoid that kind of all the oscillations and all the instabilities. So that's kind of the rough differences. Okay, then to the last part, and that's the data acquisition and conversion. So now we've been talking about various signals. We've been discussing in part A a lot of signals and how current voltage signals and so on, and different components, amplifiers. We've been mainly concentrating on voltage signals. In some cases, discussed about current as well, but mainly the signals that we've been discussing is voltage. But then the question is that, okay, we have a certain voltage in a system, input signal, output signal. Then, okay, how to measure it? We had this measurement equipment discussed at some point. We had these ammeters and voltmeters with this moving coil systems, which are analog meters. Then we have this multimeters, digital multimeters discussed, where you do it different. So actually, we come there here. So if you take a moving coil meter, and well, you can measure the whatever value, but then how to store that anywhere? So you would need to take a paper and pen and write it down, and then change something in your circuit, and then take another value, and that would be really difficult. So that's why we have because electronics is basically part of automation. So you would like to make everything automatic, so you wouldn't need to do this kind of paper and pen stuff too much. Then we will now check something about the data acquisition and how it's been done, the basics of it. So sampling. So if we have a something changing, or even if we have a something rather stable, then we would need to take measurements out of it. Especially if you have a varying quantity of something, in order to get an idea whether it's growing or if it's going down or if it's oscillating back and forth, we would need to take samples every now and then. So if you have a temperature, and we would like to know whether temperature is going up or going down, or if it goes go up and down, we would need to take samples of the temperature with a certain interval in time in order to draw conclusions what is happening. So basically, it's applies to all the measurements. So whether it's voltage, current, you name it. And so if you now just stick with voltage and varying signals like AC signals, which are periodic signals for the time being, then the question is how often you should take a sample from a signal in order to interpret and know about the signal, what type of signal it is. There is a sampling theorem by Nyquist that the sampling rate, that how often you would need to take samples of the signal, it should be at least twice the frequency of the highest frequency contribution or highest frequency component of the signal that we are sampling. And this is called this minimum sampling rate. So how many samples per second, it's called a Nyquist rate. So if we now illustrate a bit what this means. So if we have an original signal, this is just a simple one frequency sinusoidal, so which is in some system. It has a frequency f, so the period is 1 over f. So now if we take samples above this Nyquist rate, so we take samples so that during this one period, we take more than two samples. So we now take 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4. So on average, we take about five samples per period. And if we now just take a long time and look at this signal for a long time, and we take these samples, we can reconstruct this waveform just by these samples. So we have taken this sample, we're taking data from here, 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 and then we just have a lot of them because this is clean sinusoidal. We can reconstruct that from these samples. We didn't take all the data. We just took part of the data, and we can kind of look at the data, and we can see that, okay, it looks like a sinusoidal with this frequency. Of course, it's not exactly, if you like they make that data acquisition, and we would like make a even finer, take samples with finer and finer details and faster and faster, we can always fine tune and see some small variances, but basically we can get quite good answer already with quite a few samples taken. However, if we now only take two and sometimes one, so on average less than two samples per period, then if we now start reconstruct based on that information, this signal, we see that this dashed line is the one that we got, and here is the original is overlaid here, so we are quite far off from the original because we took too few samples of the signal, we cannot reconstruct based on that. So that's why we need to take enough data in order to and there's this kind of limit, this Nyquist rate limit is that. So one thing to note is that it's not the highest frequency, it's not double the highest frequency of interest. So if we are just interested in let's say 20 kilohertz signals, and then we can say, okay, let's just take samples that are higher than taken at higher rate than 40 kilohertz or 50 kilohertz or something like that. But there might be some noise and things that affect, and some other signals that we are not necessarily interested in, but they can contribute to that overall signal that we have. So we have several different frequencies in that particular signal that we are now measuring. And if we don't kind of sample taking those higher frequencies into account, then we might reconstruct again something different than we are supposed to. So of course, filtering is one thing. So you can filter it first, the signal, and then sample it so that you are actually sampling. So you don't have to sample like really, really high sample rates. If of course we have some limits in the equipment, so you are not you cannot take infinite frequencies. So if the signal that we are looking at has these unwanted high frequency components like noise and whatever other electromagnetic interference from somewhere else that we are not kind of interested in. Then if you use a low pass filter, which is called an anti-aliasing filter, and then you can filter those high frequency parts away that you are not interested in. So then you only need to sample that filtered signal at the Nyquist rate, which is about 20, or we kind of rule of thumb is take a little bit more samples than needed in order to get rid of and see, because not fil the filters are not always perfect. So there are some imperfections in the filtering. So take a little bit more samples than you would kind of the textbook would say to take, and then you can reconstruct signal well. So here's an example that we have a signal. So we have a sinusoidal signal, but there's a lot of noise. So there's high frequency noise on top of, so there's all kinds of frequencies, and a certain you can see that the amplitude of your signal is so the signal to noise ratio is okay, but it's still not like perfect, and not it should be higher in order to get a better idea of the signal. So what we can do, we can take, if we just take samples with a certain rate from the blue or the original raw signal, and if we take samples from there, we can see that we take samples which are on the right side. They are quite messy. So if you start reconstruct the signal based on these data, then it's hard to say what's the amplitude of the sinusoidal, and if it's a pure sinusoidal, or is there several different sinusoidal signals on top of each other, or what is it? But if you know that, okay, the frequency of those that signal that we are interested in is below a certain frequency. So now we put a low pass filter with it filters all the high pass high frequency components off, and now we filter it, so we get this red data over here, and then we sample that red data, and then what we see is that it actually gives us this nice sinusoidal signal that without those high frequency noise components. But of course, you need to be careful when you filter, because sometimes this is just a simple single sinusoidal signal that we are interested in here. But normally, you will have different frequencies and different amplitudes, which are all in the same mix of signals. So if you start filtering it, there might be you need to know where to put the cutoff frequency in order not to kind of filter interesting signals away from your data. So that's something to keep in mind. And then about signal reconstruction. Okay, so we have now we have taken from the analog signal, we have taken samples which we will turn into a, so we have a discrete points in time and discrete values for each of the position in time. And then sometimes we would like to reconstruct that into a signal to put out somewhere as an analog signal. We will talk about this analog to digital and digital to analog conversions in a minute. But then if you think about, we have a time point in time, we have a certain value, then we go to a next sampling point, that's and then we have changed the value, then we have two discrete values in time for a signal, and then we don't know how it behaves in between. usually we consider that, okay, it goes with straight line from point A to point P, but it's difficult to make with components this kind of reconstruction that that there's a straight line. So how you do it, you use this kind of a reconstruction filter with that. So if you think about the original signal, we have taken samples. So the blue one is the original signal. We have taken samples with our sampling unit. So we have point in time here, we have a certain discrete value, which is here. But then between this point and the next point, the output, it doesn't know whether it should change to what. So we have this kind of a staircase or stair shape data that then at the next time spot, it realized, okay, I should be here. So it goes this kind of discrete steps. And how to smooth it out is to use this kind of a low pass filter to remove these fast changes. So we get this kind of a slightly smoother behavior. Then, of course, there is this phase shift, which can then be taken out with some other phase shifters. But we start getting this original shape of the sinusoidal with this kind of filtering. It's not perfect, but when you, this is just an illustration of how it works. But when you do it with the different time constants for these filters, you get smoother and smoother behavior. This is just an illustration how it works. Okay, then words about data converters. So we take a sample of the signal, which is the analog signal, and then we want to make it, we get the data, and then we would like to store it somewhere. So if you don't want to write all the values to a paper, then what is done is they are stored on a computer, on a memory, and of course that's a digital form. So what you would need this kind of a data converters. You would need to have analog to digital converter. So you take an analog signal and turn it into a digital signal. And then you also need this digital to analog converter. So you have this digital data, and then you want to output that to some actuator or whatever as an analog. So for example, you have MP3 files for music, and you would like to output that into a loudspeaker. Then what you need, you have digital data, and then you have an analog loudspeaker. You would need to have an analog digital to analog converter in order to have that music coming out from the loudspeakers. The resolution of this, so as said, we in digital world we have just two states, 0 and 1. So if you would just use two states and single bit, then it would be quite crude. So if music would be just loud and mute, so you would have just two. But then when you add more and more bits, so you add more and more resolution to your data, then you get closer and closer to the original analog signal that was originally there. Of course, you never get exactly, if you zoom in, you always have these steps in the data, but the more you have bits in use, the smoother you get with the data. So if you have the quantizing levels, the number of them is, so we have two states. So if you have n-bit converter, it has basically 2 to the power n discrete steps. So if you have 8-bit converter or 8-bit data, it has 256 different levels. 10-bit data is 1024 levels. So 8-bit converter gives a resolution of about 0.4%. So ha almost half a percent of resolution. So it's still quite crude resolution. It's not really good. So usually 10-bit is the minimum. So we have 12-bit, 4-bit, even 16-bit. Of course, the converter, the price of converters go almost exponentially up as you increase the resolution. But nowadays you can find already quite cheap 14-bit analog to digital converters. Of course, you can go to 20-bit and higher as well, but then it always increases the price. So, whether you take an analog to digital conversion or digital to analog conversion, there is a certain time for the so conversion time or the settling time associated with that. So you cannot take the systems cannot take like infinitely fast the samplers. So it depends on various things, but depending on the converter, you have a certain conversion time associated with that. So in general, digital to analog conversion is faster than changing than converting from analog to digital. So that's just the roughly. Of course, you have faster analog to digital converters than some of the digital to analog converters. But if you take the same price, same resolution equipment, then the DAC is faster usually than ADC. Just rule of thumb. So if you increase the resolution, so more and more bits you have, the slower it gets. So if you want to have really fast digital to analog conversion, then you have to give in from the resolution. So 8-bit digital to analog conversion is, it's they are on the market faster, but this kind of normal commercial equipment is can be done in 100 nanosecond between 100 and nanoseconds and 1 microsecond. So one microsecond is 1 megahertz roughly, and 10 megahertz is then 100 nanoseconds. They are faster for sure, DACs. And typical low-cost 16-bit converter, the settling time is in milliseconds, so it can only convert in some like kilohertz time frames or less. So, for example, video digital analog conversion, you can have like 8 bits, and then maximum sampling rate can be 100 megahertz. So it's not uncommon. And of course, all these are prices are going down, things are getting faster, resolutions are getting bigger, and so on, or better. So, or these are already a few years old data. So probably at this point, there are like these are outdated. So, but this kind of rough idea is here. So. Okay, sorry about the force zoom in. So what type of digital analog converters there are? So if the binary weighted resistor DAC, so here is an illustration. Oh, it doesn't, again, doesn't do it proper. So if we have a current to voltage converter, so we have a transimpedance amplifier here. So there is a certain current going in. There's a simple operational amplifier with a feedback resistor. So what the current going in is, so the output voltage is related to, or it's actually exactly the minus RF times the current. And now we have this this system at the input, a digital system where we have different resistors depending on how many bits we have. So if we have a 4-bit system, we have four resistors and four switches. And how it goes, this is the most significant bit. So this is the when we look at a binary number, so that's the leftmost number. So if we have one, let's say 1111, so four ones, all these switches are turned on. So there's current flowing in here, 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 and here. And then the output is at its maximum. So we have the maximum current flowing in. And if you only have one of these, so if you take the least significant bit, that's one, everything else is, so we have 0001. So this is connected. We have current that is related to this resistor here, which is then the least significant bit is RF divided by, so the output voltage is RF divided by 2 to the power n minus 1. N is now 4, because we have 4 bits in the system, times R, which is now just a kind of a it's kind of a reference for this tree here. So R, 2R, 4R, and so on. So it can be kilo or 10 ohm, 20, 40 kilo ohm, and so on. And this is how we get the output, which is related to this. So we have basically, we have different stages for the output for, in this case. So it's we have 2 to the power 4 different stages. So we have the zero, when we have zero current flowing in. Then we have the maximum when we have all ones and everything between. The problem with this is that if we increase the resolution, so we have a 10-bit converter, then we have to have 10 different resistors, and the ratio should be kind of well defined. So we should have like resistor value, which is twice, then 4 times, 8 times, 16 times, and so on. And we would have the kind of the ratio between these 10 resistors. We would have one, and then the last one is about 500, which then, of course, a problem that to get precise values with those ratios. So that's the kind of the hindsight of this type of digital analog converter. Then more sophisticated one is this kind of R2R resistor chain duck. So now we have this kind of R2R system From the least significant bit, we have a switch that goes to ground if that's if we have zero for that particle bit, and it goes to the reference voltage if we have a one over here. And what happens when we have zero here? So we switch this point to ground, then we have 2R in parallel with 2R, so that makes 1R, and then we have R in between the next, there would be a next bit here, so then we would have 2Rs before that, and then 2R like here, 2R, and then this chain here, if you look at it and you properly analyze it, it gives you quite good, or this the output is now related to this the state of each of the switches. And now we only have two types of resistors. We need R and 2R. Well, three types. We need RF as well. But in this chain, we only need two types of resistors, and we don't need to. It's easier to find resistors that have two different values and with a certain accuracy. And this thing works quite well. Then the other type of converter is analog to digital converter. So we have a analog signal, and we want to make it digital. So there are different types of doing that. And so if like a typical 8-bit converter, it takes 1 to 10 microseconds, so 1 megahertz to 100 kilohertz time frame. Then if we add more bits, it goes slower. Again, these nowadays, I think these are already outdated, so we probably can take zero, at least zeros out, or even kind of divide these maybe with 10 or 100. Because it gets more and more typical that you have sampling rates for ADC at the rate of, well, 100 kilo samples per second is quite normal. So you can have like megahertz, mega samples per second, or tens of mega, even 100 mega samples per second, or a million, 100 million samples per second nowadays. And it's not that expensive equipment. Okay, then here's an example of an ADC. So-called counter or servo ADC. And what it does is that we have a clock. So we have this crystal here going up and down. So clock signal saying this counter that count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and so on. And then we have an analog signal coming in, a comparator. Comparator is a simple operational amplifier that compares two signals. If a signal A is larger than, higher than signal B going in, then let's say we have the output is low, so it's down. But whenever this B goes above A, then our output goes high, or vice versa. So it just compares. So it's basically a simple operational amplifier can be used as a comparator. So it's whenever the non-inverting is higher than the inverting input, then our output is high. And whenever the inverting input goes higher than the other one, then the output goes low. So this we can use that as a binary or digital logic thing. So here, what it does, this thing is that we have this clock signal that is counting, starts from, we say to this that, okay, now we want to take a sample out of this analog signal. Okay, let's take it. So let's reset. We start from zero. Let's start counting upwards. and we start counting upwards, we have this digital to analog conversion, which takes this counter value and turns it into analog and compares that with the analog signal, and then feeds back that to the counter and saying that whether we are not yet reached to that value, we continue counting. Whenever this comparator says, okay, now we reached the value, it says that stop counting and take the digital value of that counter, and that's our value of the analog. That's the digital value that compares to those that analog input signal. So it likes this. So it starts counting, and then it reaches the analog signal and it stops counting. The drawback is that it always starts from zero and goes up. And so it depends on if the level is, if it's fast, if the analog input is slow, but it's slow when the analog input is high. So it kind of depends, the time of conversion depends on this on the value of the input signal. The other one is successive approximation ADC. So here what it does is that again we have a clock cycle that kind of handles the logic and the timing, so when we are doing things. And here now it doesn't start from zero and kind of going up, but there's a certain logic that it there's a certain range that it can convert. So let's say 0 to 10 volts, for example. So first it checks that, okay, it doesn't start from zero and start going up to 10, but it starts from 5. It makes this analog digital analog conversion, compares to that to the input signal, whether that's, we are still too low. Next time it goes to 7.5, for example. So it goes to halfway first of the range, then it goes from the half, it takes the 1/4 above. And if now the 7.5 is too high, then it goes halfway back, and then it still, so whatever that is between 7.5 and 5, so it's 6.25, and then it still shows that, okay, now it's still, we are still too high, so let's go back one knob, and now it's, we are too low, and then we are too high, and it kind of saturates, and at some point when this error is there's a certain limit for that uncertainty, when it says, okay, now we are accurate, it doesn't change anymore, and that's our value. And now this type of thing, it's faster than the previous one, because now whatever the original analog value or the input analog value is, it takes approximately the same amount of time for all the values within the range in order to get the value out. So it's not as dependent on the value itself, the timing for the conversion. Then another, which is widely used in digital multimeters, is a dual slope ADC. So we have a negative reference voltage here, which is fixed inside. Then we have the analog input, that is the signal that we are now interested in. Again, we have a counter that we know the clock cycle, that it counts with a certain time frame. Then we have an integrator that integrates this voltage, or actually this current that goes through this resistor with this certain RC value. So the certain time constant. So the output here goes up with this depending on the voltage here. So we charge it. We reset everything. So we put here zero with this reset, we reset the counter. Then what we do is that we start charging this this input here with this, so it goes up, and then we discharge it, and we know this rate, and we know at the point when it reaches back to zero, this comparator tells us that okay, now we reached to zero, so we know we have counted the clock cycles from here to here, and this slope we know because we know the negative voltage reference, we know this time, and it depends on how far it starts from. So if it starts from higher, then we know that so we can do the calculation and get the information about what's the analog input signal because we know the reference. So it's slow, so we cannot convert signals that are really fast moving. So it has to be kind of a relatively stable input signal. Faster ones are this. Sorry, I need to take a little bit over time. There's still a few slides to go. So the fast ADC is so-called parallel or flash ADC. When you have a lot of comparators, you have a reference signal and then a voltage division network here, then an analog input signal, and these comparators here compare this analog input to the potential here. So the higher in the chain, to higher potential here, we can get like fast the response. That even though this changes, all these logic or the states here, zero or one. So if the voltage here, the reference voltage at this point is higher than the input signal, we get high value here. Same goes for all of them. And then we have the logic that kind of compares those and makes kind of makes the calculation or definition of okay, what does it mean? Of course, everything has to be thought through, and okay, what is the reference value here, voltage, and let's say we have 10 volts here, so 5 volt gives us a certain pattern here, and 6 volts gives another pattern. And the drawback here is that if we want to have, the more we have want to have resolution to this system, then it's actually we need to have 2^n-1 logic gates or these comparators. For a 10-bit system, we would need 1023 of these in order to get that logic to work. But it's fast, so that's the good thing. But the drawback is that it's quite complex. Sample and hold gates, we already discussed about this earlier. So for this analog to digital conversion, we want to kind of freeze the input for at certain point. So we take a kind of a snapshot of the signal, and then we convert that snapshot and take some time. And meanwhile, the input signal that we are converting cannot change. So that's why we need these sample and hold gates to hold that constant value. Multiplexing is something that we can make this kind of a that we have only one output, for example, but several inputs, and then we can just choose with this multiplexer one of the inputs to go to the output, and this way we can kind of reduce the number of ADCs in our systems. If we have let's say 5 or 6 or 10 different signal paths that we want to sample, but we don't sample them like the same time. We only have one ADC, so we take samples one by one, and then we can kind of reduce the need for complex equipment. And this is there's some switches, and they are operated in a certain manner in these multiplexers. So here's a kind of a schematic. So we have analog inputs, and we have this analog multiplexer that just changes between the inputs, and we have one ADC that starts the conversion, ends the conversion, say, takes that data to the system, and then the electronic system says, okay, let's change the channel and take the ADC again and stores that value in a proper manner. And we need this sample and hold case. We could take it so that we take the sample simultaneously. We take a sample for all of them, and then we kind of rotate through those inputs. So we take at certain time point in time, we take a sample from each of them same time, and then we kind of take and convert those samples into the systems. And then we can take it, it's more like simultaneous data acquisition. Of course, meanwhile, when we kind of go through these inputs can change whatever, but we don't mind it because it doesn't change this value that we are converting to the digital signal. The output can go the same way. So we can have sample and hold gates. We could use also, well, this is kind of a multiplexer for the output. So we have a digital to analog conversion. So we output that to all of them. However, with the sample and hold control, we just let that signal to go to a single output. Of course, this logic can be also controlled so that it goes to multiple ones, depending on what we want. But this way we can kind of also multiplex the output signals to multiple different analog outputs. Okay, I don't know, this is more, so these ADCs and multiplexers, they are kind of usually nowadays they are in a single integrated circuit. So you don't necessarily need a separate ADC and a separate multiplexer. They come in one package. So they are in a single chip. And nowadays it's even more that you have these systems on chip, these SoCs that has all the stuff. So you have microprocessor, you have ADCs, you have multiplexers, you have DACs and all kinds of stuff in very compact package. Okay, now we are at the end of this chapter and the end of the course. So sorry about the overtime. So analog signals, that's the starting point usually always, that you are measuring something, temperature, voltages, currents, whatever. That's analog. So you have to digitize them and take samples of those signals one way or another. And they are, we discussed about those ways of taking the samples. The main thing is that you, depending on what type of samples or how fast signals we are talking about, you should sample it at least twice the rate of the original signals. So this Nyquist rate is determining that you get good quality data if you take enough samples. That's kind of an obvious thing. And if you have a broad spectrum in frequencies, you can filter them in order to get rid of the kind of noise and other signals that you are not interested in. So then it's easier for your sampling. You don't have to worry about that. So if you are not filtering, then you probably, if you are all doing everything so-called electronically or digital, then you need to take a lot of samples really fast, and then you need to filter them after you have sampled them. So that's also possible, but then the problem is that you have to have a really high sample rates or sampling rates for your ADC. it's not always possible. So if you use an analog filter, then you can manage with kind of cheaper and more simple and slower ADC systems. And that's about it for this. So is there any questions arised? I had to a little bit rush on this chapter. I apologize for that, but now we have gone through all the stuff needed for this course. Okay, if there's nothing, no questions, comments, then I thank you all for the course and hope you good luck for the exam and good Christmas time next month. So, okay, thank you all.